folks, and welcome to another edition of Food for Thought. On today's episode, we're speaking with Sasha Moosey, Director of Agribusiness and Agri-Food Market Development at ATB Financial, one of the leading lenders to the agricultural space in Western Canada. I'm really excited to speak with Sasha, as very few get to see the ag tech, craft beer, and cannabis space from the 35,000-foot view that Sasha does. Prior to ATB, Sasha worked with Calgary Economic Development and UK Trade Investment. He is also an advisor to Provision Analytics, a Canadian startup leading the digital transformation of the food industry. Sasha, welcome to Food for Thought, and thanks for being here.
Thanks, Mike. Really happy to be here.
All right, let's jump right in. So with ATB being a strategic partner to many innovative companies in the ag tech space, what most excites you about the technology and investments being made into growing Canada's food security?
Honestly, the excitement for me isn't so much around the specific technology, rather around the opportunity to further advance a sector that's so relevant to our day-to-day life. No matter which way you look at it, food is an essential part of our daily lives. And this has been even further exemplified through COVID, really. When I first started out in ag and food, I had come from the mining and oil and gas sector, where automation, driving efficiency, and adopting technology was becoming pretty commonplace. Then as I looked into ag and food, there were countless reports that suggested it was the least digitized industrial sector. And, you know, as I started to dig a little deeper, this was proving to be the case. And the funny thing is, this was automatically associated with that segment not being very technical or interested in advancing business through innovation. Yet some of the most innovative people I've met are in the ag and food space. So as I dug a little deeper, the problem really was around much of this innovation was siloed in nature. It was never looked at, you know, the supply chain of food was never looked at as a, how do we address the full supply chain of food? And how do we look at it from a beginning to end, from farm to fork? And it's really that excites me. If we want to be food secure, we need to be innovative and up and down the line, really, of food and ensure connectivity between all the nodes of the supply chain so we can truly make a more efficient, safe, and reliable system.
So one of the things, Sasha, that is a hot topic today is animal versus plant-based proteins. And so the consumer is traditionally used to animal proteins, but that's quickly changing with the introduction of plant-based proteins on a commercial scale. Are many of these proteins being harvested in Canada? And if so, which crops specifically?
Yeah, so absolutely they are. You know, I actually believe Canada is the number one supplier of plant-based protein, specifically pulses. This includes everything from lentils, dry peas, beans, chickpeas, and even quinoa or hemp. I think this is an immense opportunity for Canada, really. And given the novel and early stage development of this segment, we Canada more broadly have an opportunity to truly own it and develop it in a way that allows us to retain the value of the commodity and not just export it. This doesn't come without a large capital investment, though. I think that's the big call out. You know, there is a unique opportunity for us to break out of our habit of always being a raw export nation, but it's going to take some serious investments. And just like more conventional animal-based proteins, Canada has an opportunity to be a significant, if not the most significant player in this space. I think it's also worth mentioning that it's not always about which protein source is the best between animal and plant. They all have their pros and cons. Canada and the prairie specifically have an opportunity to be a protein capital of the world, and that should really consider all proteins. It's not about displacing one or the other. It's about providing choice and consuming all proteins in moderation.
Very interesting. Are there protein sources that the average consumer is currently unfamiliar with, but that could soon end up on their plates in the next, we call it 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I'm smiling on the other side because yeah, there is. I mean, there's always some interesting stuff, and I don't know if it's necessarily that the consumer is not familiar with it. It's whether they're comfortable with it. There's a variety of protein sources in development, and many of them actually here in Canada. And this could include everything from lab-grown meat to proteins derived from algae and even bug production. Given the stigma of all of these kind of segments, there are some concerns around the consumer adoption, but it's like anything. If we can provide choice with good taste and consistent consistency profile, you'd be surprised what we'll adapt to and even crave. You know, who would have thought that the veggie burger would be as such a staple product for us these days, or that dairy substitutes would have such a strong market, would have such strong market growth over the past few years. You know, that said, much of the development of the algae and bug based proteins, those ones that might have some more interesting stigma around them, they're really focused in North America anyways around the feed market, so food for our food. And this can extend from everything from aquaculture, fish farming, right through to cattle feed.
Yeah, that's really interesting you make that point. We actually had Keith Driver from Intera Feed as a featured guest. And one thing that I think surprises consumers is that the black flies that they are insect farming consume 180 to 200 tons a day of organic material that normally would end up in landfills. And so with food waste being a hot topic in North America, who would have thought that, you know, insect farming is actually helping in a very material way of reducing food waste. So
one, I think that's a really good point. That's something that's going to bring down the stigma, because there's a lot of talk around, you know, consumer demand and consumer interest, and that closing of the loop and ensuring waste reduction plays a really strong role in this. So those are all, you know, pros to this for sure. Mm-hmm.
As a staunch supporter of the Western Canadian agriculture industry, what is one thing you'd say to the average Canadian consumer about our farming and ag tech community and where it's heading?
This could probably take up the whole session. And, you know, I was thinking about this a little bit. You know, at the end of the day, we're global leaders in food production, from best practice to quality of product. And Canadians by nature don't really promote themselves, both as a consumer or as businesses. And for this reason, we're not always recognized as being at the forefront of innovation or even as a thought leader in healthy and sustainable food production. Yet we supply many of the ingredients for so many of those products. The consumer in general has a growing interest in where our food comes from, and through innovation and appropriate support mechanisms, we have an opportunity to be an even more substantial food producer and, you know, really top three in the world.
Interesting. That's great to hear. Speaking of food, hemp is becoming more prevalent for consumers in the forms of seeds, oils, etc. ATB has a lot of experience with farmers that have been planting this crop for years on end in Western Canada. However, the economics and market fundamentals have been challenged in recent years with the introduction of legal cannabis and many more farmers switching over to plant this crop, resulting in a surplus and, you know, some difficulties around how to actually properly harvest the crop. What are these challenges specifically, and what should the average Canadian know about hemp, where it comes from, things of that nature?
You know, there's a few things to cover here. Hemp and the cannabis space is an interesting topic, and there are some distinctions between it. So really, the first distinction is around the fact that hemp is part of the cannabis family, as is marijuana. And the real distinction between the two is hemp is a variety of cannabis plant that contains less than 0.3 THC, whereas marijuana is a variety that has more than 0.3 THC. This is a necessary distinction because THC is the part of the plant that holds a psychoactive component inside of cannabis. And given that hemp has always been less focused on that psychoactive piece, aspects of the plant have been utilized for multiple purposes. Really, hemp, there's three main purposes: food, fiber, and CBD. For the last 20 years, Canada has been farming hemp under the industrial hemp regulations, which was always been for the purpose of food and fiber production. It was only really in September 2018, I believe, that hemp was brought into the Cannabis Act and that the CBD holding components of the plant could be utilized. Prior to this, and for food and fiber only, the stalk and seed, or hemp hearts, if you will, were able to be harvested. And the flower and the chaff, which hold the CBD components, were left on the field. So it's interesting because we talk about the challenges, and yes, harvesting has been a challenge, but harvesting was focused very much on the seed and stalk side of things, not on the flower and chaff. So we've had to see the infrastructure change and new solutions there. But, you know, okay, if there's these challenges, why the increased interest in production? Where do we want to go? And technically, the plant now has three revenue streams. And given some of the hype built south of the border on the value of hemp-derived CBD, farmers began to consider how they could include a new cash crop into the rotation. And the problem here is that the genetics in Canada anyways have been really catered towards the food production and the fiber aspects. So CBD yields have been all over the place. And then B, CBD extraction and production has been a bit of a bottleneck in Canada. Yes, the cannabis industry is significant here, but the extraction piece really only opened up with Cannabis 2.0 this past October. So a lot of that infrastructure is still very much needed. And that's really for the fiber side and the CBD aspects of business. So to me, this really smells like a lot of opportunity, but you know, I'll let the audience decide.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. What would sort of the typical format be that consumers have been consuming hemp? I mean, we'll see hemp hearts in the grocery aisle. Are there others that are currently being consumed or that you foresee down the road?
No, I think it's really been around the seed, but the seed kind of plays a couple different roles. It can be consumed in its own right as a ingredient in smoothies or different products, and then it's also an ingredient into other foods. So I think it's all about that hemp seed piece. There is an ability to extract protein from the hemp plant as well, but similar to pulses in general or the hemp industry, a lot of this still needs to be built out. I've definitely seen technologies that can do it. Scale, that's another question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's definitely some viewers on Food for Thought that are small scale food startups. Walk us through the process for when a financial institution like ATB would come into the fold for a food startup that has proven a concept in a micro setting, but is looking for capital to help them scale up.
Yeah, you know, this is a tough one to answer because there's really no one answer. A lot of this is taken on by case by case. Simply put, you know, early stage startup financing is difficult to approach, no matter which way you look at it, from a debt perspective. In a conventional practice, if a company or even a person for that matter wants to access debt, they need to prove that they can service that debt through income generated and more specifically the free cash flow left over to pay that debt back. It's here that startups often miss the point with financial institutions. They come to the bank with an investor pitch and not a banking pitch. What I really mean by that is they come to us all excited about the opportunity and what the end value will be once this company's up and running at full scale with no more issues, right? We see that big opportunity. This often appeals to the investor because they can be more patient with their capital and at the same time can lock in a more significant return or payback. A bank, on the other hand, wants to know how you can start to pay them back in 30 days, really. Sure, there's ways to negotiate that and work around it, but the idea is how do we start repaying that debt through the cash flows of the business? And it's here that we work with and advise companies to get them over some of these hurdles in an effort to make them bankable. So, you know, that's a bit of a long-winded answer, but it's to bring out the point that every case is a bit unique and we look to provide everything from financing to advice in an effort to support our clients in any way we can.
Absolutely. That's great insight on the difference between, you know, bank lending versus investor capital. Speaking of which, is ATB actively working with companies that find themselves in food incubators and accelerators, you know, similar to a District Ventures in Calgary, or I know Arlene Dickinson just raised $100 million VC fund. Is ATB involved in this ecosystem at all?
Yeah, we definitely do. You know, we're incredibly focused on ecosystem development. As I mentioned above, sometimes these companies are more investment ready than they are bankable, and initiatives like District Ventures help scale companies to that position. In the District Ventures example, actually, we're also one of the initial LPs, ATB. We had helped fund part of that initial fund for Arlene. And as such, we play a role on both sides of that equation. Then we provide support to an initiative such as District Ventures, which in turn develops and commercializes more companies, which then increases the number of companies and ultimately benefits the Canadian economy and the companies we're looking to work with. In theory, it provides a great loop of opportunities for everybody in the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of VC funding, are you worried at all about funding of new innovation with all sectors of funding being hit very hard by COVID-19, everything from, you know, VCs to private equity guys coming in a little bit later stage, high net worth individuals funding, sort of acting as pre-seed rounds, angel investors. I mean, scale is everything in food, and money is required to build and scale a brand. Are you worried at all about where any of this liquidity comes from, or is there more smart money on the sidelines that we'll start to see put to work here in post-COVID?
Yeah, you know, this is a really interesting question. And given my interest and focus on the innovation space, it's really a concern. You know, as we talk to investors, be it private equity or venture, there has been some flags put up for sure. You know, liquidity is going to be an issue. Everybody's going to claw back what they can to make sure that they are safe on their own accord, and then we'll kind of figure it out. It's interesting though, because as I'm sure we've all really heard, in crisis, there's always opportunity. And this one's been a really interesting crisis to look at, because it shines so much light on the need for a resilient and dependable food supply chain. Whether it's about improving production capacity or increasing supply chain infrastructure or even food safety, all these areas have room for improvement. So it'll be really interesting to see if that excites capital in the same way and we see more of it flow into the segment in light of COVID. Or to your point, is it really just going to kind of lock up? I don't think we have an answer for that, but you know, I think this kind of addresses your smart money comment. I think there is smart money out there that's looking at how to diversify itself and land in the right spot. At the end of the day, liquidity for companies and investors will be an issue, no doubt. But it does present an opportunity to diversify our portfolios and likely into segments that could potentially outperform during a crisis. And then on the other side of this, right? Food is an essential service today, but it's always been an essential service. So it's got some longevity in it. Will we see a slowdown in general VC and private equity capital movement? Probably. And when I say general, those are the organizations that aren't really focused on ag and food. But you know, the ones that I've been speaking with that are, their core focus is agriculture and food, things keep kind of moving as per usual. They've got companies in their portfolio that are doing better than they expected. They got some that maybe not, but I think everybody sees that solution. So really my question is, will this crisis divert some of the capital that feels it's more at risk in other segments to the ag and food space? It's not always the highest set of returns, but it does often seem to be the most dependable in good times and bad.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch gears over more to supply chain focus. Do you think that global food supply chains and trade routes will be quick to respond, or will a greater emphasis post-COVID be placed on eating local, supporting small and medium-sized businesses, and more sort of farm-to-fork type models?
Yeah, you know, I think it's going to be a little bit of all of the above. You know, due to the impacts on the supply chain, there's again light shining on it, and you're starting to see a keen interest in that local food push. If we've got food sovereignty issues or food security issues, we want to make sure we can produce more local food. I think that makes good sense. But it also flags the gaps in our local food system. So you'll see a bit of a push towards supporting domestic supply chain in a more sovereign way. For example, you know, products that maybe we're not used to growing or consuming from a Canadian perspective that we import. Can we start to bring in more of those fruits, for example, in different regions? That's always going to be a challenge in Canada. But we do have an opportunity to capitalize on that kind of development of the supply chain. You know, we saw a lot of this interest on the supply chain, both locally and internationally pre-COVID. This is always a concern. COVID just kind of highlighted it. And what it highlighted is the need for more infrastructure. At the end of the day, it seems like both sides of this are going to benefit, and that would be the best case scenario. I don't really see Canada growing avocados at the end of the day. We're still going to need to access that product. That's the global supply chain. But can we strengthen locally? I think you're going to see that for sure.
Mm-hmm. So within the topic of supply chain, there's been a lot of focus on increased food wastage, and that's largely, you know, driven by food service demand effectively going to zero. What innovative ways do you see the commercial and industrial scale food industry combating these issues?
Yeah, so you know, this is a really big question, and given, you know, how recent it all is, I'm not sure there's good solutions yet. I do think we've seen a lot of companies look at addressing their food waste issues by focusing on, you know, the retail market or direct to consumer market. That said, the whole supply chain will not be able to transition in order to reduce all that waste, especially in the perishable goods side. So, you know, for this, you also see that charitable opportunity as well. And we do see companies ensuring as much of that food as possible does not go to waste. and it moves to the markets that actually really need it at any cost right now. But as for what kind of innovations, this one's tough because, you know, it's easy to connect the dots around some kind of composting or waste value add opportunity, but a lot of this still needs to be developed. And you can also look at some of the waste being repurposed into the feed solutions. You mentioned Anterra Farms earlier, and that's a great example. That food waste can be put into different feed products and ensure our other food value chains have access to those inputs. A good example is that actually in the potato industry. Now, we know some of the potato industry does move into the feed side, but given the reduction in processed French fries, really, or potatoes for French fries, really, because of hospitality dying, we've now got a surplus of potatoes, and those might be able to move into different feed and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. From a consumer perspective, you know, do you see sort of cash crippled consumers out of financial necessity opting for, you know, lower grade carbohydrate dense foods that are typically, you know, manufactured by, you know, big box CPG companies? You know, on one hand, I see kind of a bifurcation in the retail market in terms of those going ultra local and sustainable, really placing a large emphasis on, you know, building the community and local food ecosystems and supply chain, versus those that, you know, have been hit really hard financially. They've lost jobs, they've lost income, and, you know, having to out of necessity eat, you know, go for a, you know, boxed food at grocery stores until they're back on financial footing. How do you see consumers, you know, preferences shifting post-COVID?
You know, this one's a really interesting one to me. Your comment around what we're seeing on the different retailers kind of focusing on, and on local, I think in the short term, that's just about ensuring they've got, you know, the right amount of product there for the consumer, the amount of choice. So at this point, we'll pick it up from anywhere to make sure that we have what the consumer wants. But, you know, I've done a little bit of research on this in my time here, and in my research around previous economic recessions, is what came out of that is that the consumer message is always around local and high quality purchasing pattern. Like, we're going to support local. We want to be there for that. But when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, the decision is primarily based on the dollars and cents. What can I afford? And so you tend to see those lower price staples moving primarily, even though the consumer wants it, they're still going after that. I think we saw that in a lot of the staples, whether it be canned product moving off or flour or whatever that might've been. You know, given many of the supply chains, the staple supply chains haven't really been affected. I think flour was probably the most affected just because the demand had increased so much. But it's hard to build a case that the consumer will fully move out of large scale CPG. I just think right now they need a bit of both. They're going to try to support where they can, but at the end of the day, their bank account's going to make that decision for them.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of the retail experience and how consumers have traditionally shopped for groceries, because of COVID, we've now seen a much greater emphasis on, you know, D2C models, but also the adoption of meal kits. Do you see sustained traction there or material changes long-term in terms of how consumers are going to go about purchasing their food?
Yeah, it really depends on the demands of the consumer. The demand today is very much put on by the crisis and the situation. I need to access food somehow. So if there's an online option, let's look at it. So if that keeps up, then yes, there may be more emphasis on that direct to consumer piece. And given the increased numbers around online shopping, it's reasonable to assume that there will be some ongoing growth. Will everyone focus on direct to consumer? I don't think so. But the crisis has forced many people to use the system when they may have not been comfortable. And when I say the system, this is the online ordering system. They might have not been really interested in that because they weren't comfortable doing things digitally pre-COVID, but now their choices were limited. And they might find that it actually works better with their lifestyle. So as a result, there will likely be substantial efforts towards retaining those new customers that have come online or looked at different routes. But that said, we're still very social beings. And I think you'll see a lot of consumers still focus in on the retail market, you know, going out for dinner. That part's not going to stop. It's just going to take a little bit longer to tick back on. And so that means, yeah, likely digital infrastructure is going to help us marry the gap between the two. At the end of the day, there's probably going to be a bigger mix now of direct to consumer versus wholesale.
Mm-hmm. I want to be respectful of your time. So I think we have, you know, space here for one more question that I'll throw at you. What can the Canadian government do to help the Canadian economy capture more value within the Canadian food supply chain to help increase our food security? Is it the government, you know, providing certain incentives? Are there structural things? You mentioned, you know, capturing more value within Canada than simply being an export driven nation. Are there some, you know, easy, you know, wins on the table, or is this really going to take the best and brightest in the food and ag tech space coming together and really trying to, you know, reshape the Canadian food industry?
Yeah, you know, I get it's a tough one. There's an opportunity for government, industry, and innovators to come together and start to address the challenges and build out the infrastructure. It's not just on one of those parties, it's all three parties really being willing to be at the table and have those discussions. You know, as you kind of brought up, there's an opportunity to continue to add value that's capital intensive. So we need to figure out how does that really align with the opportunity and which ones do we chase. Protein crops, again, because we produce so much of them, they tend to make sense there. And you've seen some positive initiatives, whether it be the Protein Innovation Canada super cluster, really focused in on that piece, developing the value add side and reaching the market for value added protein crops. So we want to see that kind of momentum. We want to see that kind of thing continue on. I don't think there's any short wins. It's all about a long-term game. You know, I was having a discussion the other day with somebody on this, and agriculture has never been focused on an overnight success. So we can't look at it that way. It's got to be a long-term play. Food's always going to be here. We're always going to need food. So let's think about what that structure might look like in year 1, 3, 5, 10, 15, and so on. We need to be looking at that long run as well.
Well said. Well said. Well, I appreciate you coming on the on Food for Thought here, Sasha, and we appreciate you taking the time.
Hey, look, I'm really excited you guys are doing this, and I'm excited to be a part of it. Thank you guys for including me, and I look forward to keeping the discussion going.